Hi, and welcome to D-Listers of History, a podcast about people you've never heard of who changed the world. I'm Faga, and I'm a public historian and tour guide.
And I'm Mazal, a mixed media artist, and I'm also Faga's wife.
Today we have an interview with a great guest, Jack Marr. Jack Marr is a historical novelist, a proud fifth-generation Coloradan, and grandson of Eric Douglas. Eric Douglas was a groundbreaking Denver Art Museum curator, Native arts champion, and the focus of Jack's bestseller, Poppy, a novel about a colorful Colorado life. Prior to becoming a novelist, Jack worked at top-rated NBC affiliate KUSA-TV in Denver as a Nine News multimedia journalist and executive producer. A five-time Emmy winner, Jack is the recipient of multiple broadcasting honors from the Associated Press and the Colorado Broadcasters Association. I had so much fun talking to Jack about his grandfather, and it opened up a really interesting story that I hadn't thought much about.
Most of us take for granted that most art museums have Native American art in their collections, but this was not always the case. Eric Douglas worked tirelessly to expose white Americans to Native American art and pushed for it to be rightfully seen as the equal of European and European American art.
What I find striking about Eric Douglas is that he is yet another example of people who see marginalized people, in this case, the Hopi, Diné, Nooch, Zuni, and other indigenous people Eric interacted with, as equals. A common refrain in history is that you have to accept people as artifacts of their times. Well, Eric was of his time, but even today, he would be considered somewhat radical in many corners.
As we discussed with Jack, he wasn't perfect, but there's a lot we can learn from his imperfections. We don't want to extol another white American for doing the bare minimum, but frankly, Eric didn't do the bare minimum. Eric gives white Americans an example of looking beyond the settler-centered narratives we have been taught to embrace and respect Native American art and culture without falling into cultural appropriation.
A few notes before we begin. While all three of us in this conversation have done a lot of work to readjust our historical perspectives, I am sure there will be things we missed. So, a general content warning for discussing the relationship between white America and Native Americans through the late 19th and early to mid 20th centuries. Language also changed a lot over that time, so it is worth a warning that outmoded language is discussed. When discussing historical events and proper nouns, we use terms like American Indian or the shortened Indian that were the accepted terminology for the day. When discussing the present or within our modern context, we use nation names and Native American or Indigenous North Americans.
Like Eric Douglas, we all are always learning about the wealth of living Indigenous American cultures across the country. Our goal today is to both honor the memories of the Native American artists Eric worked with and think about how we can do better as a country.
You could come with me. You could come with me.
Welcome, Jack. We're so happy to have you. I really enjoyed your book, Poppy. I had a really fun time getting to know Eric. So the book is technically a novel, but it's based on the true story of your grandfather.
Correct.
What did that research process look like for you? Like, was it mostly family stories, or did you go into archival stuff or a mix?
Well, let me tell you a little bit about the origin of this whole thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
As you know, most of my career was spent in TV news, the majority at a Denver station, the NBC affiliate here. And growing up, because I am a Denver native and a fifth generation Coloradan, you would think that I would have a lot of this, you know, in my DNA and in my background. But the reality was much different. I grew up in something of a dysfunctional household. My mom did her best. I lost my dad early when I was 14. And she just really had a lot of issues with her mental health and other things. And so really, for us, it was more about just surviving day to day. And it wasn't until her mother, a beautiful, wonderful woman named Frida, who realized that our little family just was coming apart, that she needed to kind of come into our lives and stabilize our lives. And she did that. And I credit her with just pulling us out of this darkness and giving me something of a normal life. And so that's the figure that I saw as a young person, was this really strong, stable woman who originally was from Philadelphia.
Love that. I was very excited.
And this whole other part of her life involving Native Americans and Native American art and the Denver Art Museum, she really didn't share a lot of that with us. It was all about, you know, writing checks for the rent and making sure we got up for school and just the day-to-day things. And the only time she made reference to her previous life with Eric Douglas was when she handed me a supplement to the Denver Post. It was called Empire Magazine. It was published every now and again, and it was about history. And the cover story was about the Douglas family and about this beautiful home they had up in Evergreen called Camp Neosho. She handed it to me and she said, you know, Jack, you may want to hang on to this someday. It's about our family. And that was pretty much the extent of my education about the Douglas family. And I have wondered for some time now why she wasn't more forthcoming about that part of her life. Fast forward, after many, many years, I was invited by the Denver Art Museum as one of the last remaining descendants of the Douglas family to come and lecture before a society devoted to my grandfather. And honestly, I was terrified because all I had was this little Empire magazine and little bits of what he was about. And so I did some fast research, and then I found myself lecturing in some of these people, and I admitted to them, you know more about my grandfather than I did, but I'll do my best. And I kind of stumbled through this 90-minute lecture. Well, I finally retired from TV News, and I just decided, you know, my grandfather and what he did, from what I was able to gather, is worth a lot more than some bumbling lecture. So I spent 2 years researching his life and his history and his roots. And the result is this book, Poppy, which I'm so glad you read. Thank you for doing that. And it was a labor of love that I'm very proud of.
That's really interesting. Actually, it really speaks to me too, because I've had to like kind of rediscover a lot of family history too. Yeah, so why did you decide to make it a novel instead of
nonfiction? Well, you know, I just looked at a lot of the material that the Denver Art Museum had already put together. They had put a 100-year history together that included Eric Douglas's accomplishments. There were technical papers related to a lot of his work with the different tribes and documenting the potters and the weavers and whatnot. But there just wasn't a lot of heart to it. And so I figured I'd use those as the bones for this novel. And I wanted to really put more heart into his history and his story and his relationships. All of the incidents in the book are based on real things, but I had to invent a lot of the dialogue and a lot of things that occurred. And I'll tell you, I'll give you an example. In the towards the beginning of the book, I talk about a 1921 expedition that Eric was on with his father through Monument Canyon, Arizona. And during the course of this expedition, they rescue a mule who falls into a pine tree. And I got that from a diary that Eric's dad put together. And he was a great writer, but you know, a lot of the time he didn't put a lot of detail into what happened. And so there was just this entry, you know, we made camp, beautiful sunset. Oh, and we rescued a mule from a pine tree, period. What? And so I had to use my imagination. How did the mule get in the tree? How did they rescue him? You know, what was that all about? And so that's what I did. I would take these real events and then extrapolate from them.
So you had a bunch of diaries from your great-grandfather then?
That is correct. Winfred Douglas. And if I could, I'd like to take a moment to talk about him, because I think Eric's interest in Native American art stems from his dad.
Yeah, for sure. Let me just pause you, because that is actually where I want to start. I just want to put in the good old, like, Eric was born in 1897 in Evergreen, Colorado. But yeah. And the book starts at the end of his life, but that scene in 1921 to me felt very much like the beginning, and I really enjoyed learning about Winfred. So yes, go forth.
So Winfred Douglas, he was an Episcopalian priest, and he specialized in music. And he loved something called plain song. And for anybody that has studied ancient music, they know plain song is this, if you listen to it in a church, which I have, it almost does open up a window to heaven, depending on, you know, your faith and what you think. And he spent his life devoted to studying plain song, this ancient music that's sung by monks in Europe and whatnot. And he wanted to bring it mainstream into the Episcopal Church. And so that's what he did. He was in the New York area, and he would just exhaust himself studying this music and transcribing it and writing new music based on it that he wanted to put into the Episcopal hymnals that were in use at that time. He would just spend hours at the organ composing. There was something about this Douglas family. They tended to work themselves into exhaustion. Well, one night he was found like in a coma at the base of the organ because he just had been working nonstop. And he was hospitalized, and they diagnosed him with all kinds of problems. He had a history of health problems. He had a classmate who pushed him down the stairs. He worked in a thermometer factory before he was a priest.
That'll do it.
And he lost all of his teeth because of the exposure to mercury. So it was just one health setback after another. So it was one of his superiors at his church back in the New York area who said, you know, I want you to go out west. That was sort of a thing back in the 1800s. I want you to go out west and get healthy. They sent a lot of people out here to Colorado because of tuberculosis and other lung ailments. And so he was ordered to spend time in Denver, and they transferred him to a church here. Well, that's where he met my great-grandmother. Dr. Jo was her name. She was one of Colorado's first doctors. And she co-founded a sanitarium for people with health problems, with lung problems, and that's where she met Winfred and they married. But he continued to overwork himself, and there was another health collapse. And for this one, something told him, I want to just go and spend time in the Great Southwest, in the Four Corners region. And so he went off for 6 months in what was called Indian country at the time. He had a bedroll, he had a horse, slept out under the stars, and he was just determined to build himself up. This was also the era of Teddy Roosevelt, and he was sort of setting the example, right? Let's go on horseback and get healthy.
Cure asthma by just bootstraps.
By sheer will. He did do that, and he did actually get better. And he lived among the Navajo and the Hopi. He befriended them, and he just fell in love with their culture and their art. He learned the Hopi language to the point where he was fluent, and they loved him as a blood brother. They made him a blood brother, and they gave him the name of Tall Pine Tree because Winfred was this tall man. And even though he was an Episcopal priest, he wasn't there to try to convert anybody. He obviously, you know, shared if they were curious about his faith and whatnot. But he just got this real sense of what their world was all about. And so then when he came back to his family and after Eric was born, I think this love that was born of this time just became part of their family. And so they were on this mission to collect a lot of Native American art, and they decorated this beautiful home in Evergreen with it. And then by extension, they helped the Denver Art Museum found the Native Arts Department. It was then called the Indian Art Department. Eric, just by osmosis, I think, absorbed all of this and got this love for Native American art and love of their culture.
One thing I found really interesting about, well, both of them, but Winfred clearly was the first, I guess, of the family, is that what you mentioned of learning the culture on its own terms, that he didn't come in and was sitting there like making comparisons to his own culture. I'm sure he was mentally, because anyone would, but it lacked that paternalisticness that you usually see from that era. So you read a lot of stuff from that era and you'll have these like, you know, the white man goes west and
Right. Saves them.
Bivouacs or whatever. Yeah. And it can be very bringing. Bringing is that manifest destiny of like bringing civilization to the American West. And there just seemed to be like none of that.
Well, I would like to think so. You know, I would say that the Douglases were part of an era in which there were some wealthy social reformers that had seen what a white America, what the federal government had done to Native Americans, putting them on reservations. They were struggling, they were starving, and a lot of people were very concerned, including Ann Evans, who figures into my book. She was the daughter of Colorado's second territorial governor, Governor John Evans, who was infamously associated with the Sand Creek Massacre. Mm. I think Ann Evans was one of these people because she felt tremendous guilt over what happened at Sand Creek. And so she was on this mission to try to do what she could. She was really worried that their culture was going to die out. And she encouraged Eric to maybe join in this mission of hers to go to these different areas, these different tribal areas, and to help preserve their art and also elevate it to the point where it had the same status in museums as pieces from Greece or pieces from France. There's a sequence in the book that is, again, based on a true story. I should tell you a little bit about Camp Neosho, which was their home in Evergreen. They had a beautiful log home in Evergreen that was sort of more of a summer home, and then they had a home in Denver. And where did they get this wealth to do all of this? Well, Dr. Joe was from a family that had really some pretty significant land holdings in Michigan, including Detroit. And the family story was they inherited Detroit. And it wasn't quite like that, but they did have land on which the Ford Motor Company built some of their facilities.
Oh, well, that's
wow.
And so that is where a lot of the family, you know, money came from, money which they used to purchase these Native American artifacts and then, you know, would put in museums. Well, anyway, they have this beautiful home up in the mountains, which is a museum. If you guys ever get to Colorado or any of your listeners, please come to what is now called the Hiwan Heritage Park in Evergreen. It was the home of Camp Neosho, this beautiful 17-room log home that was built by a Scottish builder named Jock Spence. And he was known for handcrafting everything. And when you see this wow. home, you just, how did they do this? With hand tools. And he would chink the logs with a mixture of mud, honey, and sand. And so wow. in some respects, it was kind of very rudimentary, but in others, it was very elegant. And he was this amazing builder that had an early eco sense of architecture. He would build around, because it was set in a pine grove of ponderosa mm-hmm. pine, and he would build certain sections of the home around the pine trees so he wouldn't have to cut them down. Well, anyway, at this beautiful home called Camp Neosho, which was named after Mary Neosho Williams, that was Dr. Joe's mom, they would have these cow camp suppers. And Winfred and Dr. Joe would invite the neighbors in Evergreen. And at that time, remember, there's no highways. There's just dirt roads and tin Lizzies. It was quite an ordeal to come from Denver up to Evergreen. You had 14 bridges you had to cross. It was a lot of mud sometimes. But anyway, their immediate neighbors in Evergreen, they'd have these corn cow camp suppers. They'd encourage people to dress up like cowboys. Frida, my grandmother, wasn't real thrilled, but she would do it. She would, on the cover of my book, you'll see her dressed in sort of an Annie Oakley thing. Mm-hmm. And then Eric has got the chaps and a leather vest, and boy, does he look the part. And Ann Evans, who lived in a mountain cabin not far away from Camp Neosho, she would come and some of the other people would come and they would talk. And it was at one of these suppers that she told Eric about her concern about the disappearing race of Indians. And she recruited him. She said, I want you to be a docent for this new Denver Art Museum that we're starting. And I want you to go to the source, the fountainhead. Basically, she wanted him to go to the Four Corners region and make contact with these artists and convince them that, you know, it would be a good thing to have their items in a museum. He agreed. And really, within a year of being the docent, he took over the whole place. I mean, they had all of these objects throughout Camp Neosho already. And so he just ended up donating a lot of them and started the Indian Arts Department with that. So it was really Ann Evans that got him involved in this whole world.
Yeah. And speaking of Ann Evans, one thing that I thought was really cleverly done from a like literary perspective, but also historical, was during that 1921, I don't know what you call it, camp out, mm-hmm. camping adventure. There's this great part where Eric, who's in this scene, Eric has just graduated from University of Colorado with his BA, and he's going to go on to, oh boy, it was University of Michigan, but then he ended up at PAFA, Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts, which first art college in the country. put that in. But this is this in-between moment when he's spending some time with his father. And he has this conversation with another person who's come along, I guess, to help, about what is officially in history called the Bluff War.
Yeah.
This was a incident in the, oh boy, I didn't write down the date. Good job, Pass Vega. Great job. Well, anyway, it's about a young man named, my apologies if this is not the right pronunciation, Senegat.
That's right. Good job.
Yes. Who was, and this is actually one of these moments where we're kind of bouncing between names. So they're known in sort of legal American tradition as, it's UTE. Is it Ute?
Ute. Yep.
But then their name for themselves is Nooch. But he was accused of robbery and murder. And there's a whole lot of stuff that happens around that. But what I thought was really clever about it, where it was included and how you included it, was we had just gotten this gorgeous portrait of Winfred going out and like meeting the Hopi and the Navajo / Diné and in this really respectful, lovely way. And this was like a reminder of what else was happening.
Exactly. And you know, that incident, it's very interesting. I did not know about this whole episode of Winfred's life until I read a remarkable book that I would also like to recommend that's called Ladies mm-hmm. of the Canyon. In it, one of the social reformers I referenced earlier was a good friend of the Douglases. Her name was Natalie Curtis. And she was on a similar mission to sort of document a lot of these old ways before they vanished. Again, there was this big concern that it was all going to go away. And so she would take what was then a newly invented recording device by Edison on horseback, going back into Navajo land and Hopi land, and she would record the songs of these tribes that could then be preserved. And she was a good friend of the Douglas family. Well, she and some of her friends heard about this story involving Senegat. He was accused of killing a shepherd and was convinced after talking with Chief Polk, his father, and some others that he was being railroaded. And so she had this circle of friends, and the murder trial was set in Denver. And Winfred Douglas was called as one of the witnesses for the defense. And I looked back on some old Denver Post reporting from the era. It occurred to me that they did not really have a good sense of the truth. There was this immense white guilt that was going on at the time. And so I think they sort of rushed to exonerate this guy who his own people for the prosecution admitted, you know, he did it. We came up over a rise. We saw him roll a body into the ravine. And yet there was this pressure on the part of a lot of people in the Denver area at that time that all these poor Indians, we've got to do something to help this guy, you know. And so in my imagination, Winfred is very regretful at having testified in his defense. I do appreciate the fact that you went through all of that and
yeah, well, and you said white guilt, and I used the term when I was writing this out. It reminded me of like white saviorism.
Yes.
This, like this idea that just because somebody is from a marginalized community means they can do no wrong.
Right.
And
right.
That is just as, I don't know if just as, it is also a harmful, harmful thing.
Just that, you know, there was a tendency by some of these people to put, you know, Native American up on a pedestal. Well, you know, they're just as human as anybody, you know, and they're going to have flaws and they're going to do bad things.
I was trying
to illustrate that through that episode, that there was that dimension too.
And I like that. I thought it did a really good job of doing that. But then also additionally being like, also like the army did come in and like kill a lot of people. So having that balance, especially when you have these people like Winfred and Eric, who are unique, I think, in a lot of ways in how they approached their relationships with the indigenous communities there.
Yeah, and I would say also with the art, it was sort of the same thing, that both Eric and his father and Dr. Joe, they recognized it not so much for the ethnographic value, but it was art. It was beautiful. Yeah. Let's not try to analyze, you know, what does this image on this pot symbolize? Just appreciate it for its gracefulness and its beauty. It doesn't necessarily have to mean anything. It can be a piece of art that you can admire just as you would a Grecian statue or a French Renaissance painting.
Yeah, and that was a really central theme throughout this book. Going to that moment that what were they called? The cowboy cookout.
The cow camp supper.
Which I thought this was really funny that you mentioned in the book that it was sort of based on this idea of like some of the local indigenous communities would do something kind of similar around their powwows. And so it's kind of it struck me as kind of humorous in a, like, that they were like, well, this looks like fun, but we're not going to obviously do a powwow because that would be, I mean, well, today we call it cultural appropriation, but like that would be not great. So we're going to do a cowboy one. And it just, something about that just tickles me. Eric sees Anne at this event. Mm-hmm. And I love that she basically insults his artistic abilities.
Yes.
In a way that I kind of appreciate as a like just okay musician too. It's like, okay, listen, man, you can make mediocre art and you're rich, so you can just do that. Or you could do something that actually matters.
Yeah, he for a while there was on track to become an artist himself. But I do think he had the good sense to realize that he didn't have that level of ability to become much more than a mediocre painter. And I don't know that Anne actually told Eric that, but it was my way of sort of inferring a little bit that I think you have another calling in life. And she definitely was instrumental in getting him on this track. And of course, Anne Evans, for those of us in Colorado, the Evans name is very familiar, not only infamously, but also famously, because she helped launch the Denver Public Library. She was involved in all kinds of artistic and cultural endeavors. Again, my read only, that she was acting out of the guilt from Sand Creek to try to, you know, do some good after the bad. There's a controversy right now involving Mount Evans, which is west of Denver, being renamed. I think it's already been done. Mount Blue Sky, the original name that the Native Americans had for it, to kind of wipe away the Evans legacy.
Yeah. And I mean, this is what we're sort of grappling with all over the place, is how do we manage that? She had at least in the book, she had this very specific task for Eric in this particular case, which was to go and talk to Nampeyo. Is that how you decided it was pronounced?
Nampeyo, who
is a Hopi potter. Mm-hmm. And we actually had a whole thing last night where we discussed like the difference between a potter and a ceramicist, because I don't know. And the difference, because I assumed there was some sort of weird like class thing there, but it's not at all. It has to do with what materials you use. And
One of those all squares are rectangles, but not all rectangles are squares sort of situations. Yeah. All pottery is ceramics. Not all ceramics is pottery. From what I can tell, it has to do a lot with both materials as well as how it is used. Potters tend to use wheels or hand building ceramics. A lot of that is also slip cast, which means you make like a slurry of clay and pour it into a mold and set it. And that's how mass manufactured ceramics are often created.
Yeah, so Mazal did, being an art person, she did some research on this art itself. And she's telling me in the car about it. It's super interesting.
Yeah, so Nanpeo, she had first learned about making pottery from her paternal grandmother. In the 1870s, she made a steady income selling her work at a local trading post that was operated by Thomas Keem.
Who I think was that in your book? I feel like that might have been in your book.
Yes. There were a couple of different, the Wetherills also had a trading post in the area. Yeah. But yeah, you're right.
Yeah, by 1881, she had already become known for her works of what they called, quote unquote, old Hopi pottery. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She really started getting into this whole idea of the pottery that we, meaning the Hopi, make today, meaning in her time, is not to the same quality as our traditional pottery. And her husband was an archaeologist. Is that correct?
I believe you are correct, yeah.
Have it written down. I just have so much written down.
I think
down.
That's what you said. I mean, based on what he did.
Yes. And yes. So her second husband was employed by the archaeologist J. Walter Fuchs at the excavation of the ancient ruins of the Hopi village. And do you say it Sikyatki?
Yes, that's about as good as I can do. Yeah. I'm sure there are Hopi listeners who are probably cringing right now, but
yeah, deepest apologies.
Yes, so sorry. That was in the 1890s, mm-hmm. and he helped Nanpeo find all these potsherds that were from centuries before. It was the 15th through 17th centuries, mm-hmm. and they would copy. They had these designs on them from the much older Hopi pottery, and Nanpeo copied these designs onto paper and then used them as motifs and designs in her own pottery. There's one pattern in particular that they called the migration pattern that had feather and bird claw motifs and represented the migration of the Hopi people. And that became really famous. She used that as a motif a lot in her work. And she had a specific style as well that became very recognizable.
I am very impressed by your level of research. That is amazing.
we'll link in the show notes some pictures of her work.
It's gorgeous.
Yeah. So
no, it is gorgeous, and it was very distinct. And Eric recognized this. And yes, he did make a very arduous trip down to First Mesa, which is where she lived. She was part of the Corn Clan. And at that time, she was trying to pass on what she knew to her daughter, Nellie, because she had this insidious eye disease, trachoma, and was basically blind. And so, you know, she was still able to make these beautiful pieces, but it was Nellie who had to complete them because obviously mm-hmm. she couldn't mm-hmm. see. But in her prime, you're absolutely right. She would descend from First Mesa, which was, you know, 600-800 feet above the desert floor, through this windy trail down to where there was a spring where she would draw water to use and put it in this real bulky canteen, like a 12-gallon canteen that she then attached to her forehead by means of a cloth or leather strap, and then would navigate all the way back up that trail so she'd have the water, you know, to make the pottery. But while she was down there, she also would scrounge around for these old shards of pottery that you referenced because she wanted to bring back the ancestors' way of doing these pots. And so when in my novel, Eric conversing with her, trying to convince her that this is something that needs to be in a museum, she doesn't really understand the concept of a museum. Why would anyone want to go and see my pots in a museum? She was pretty savvy, though, because the Santa Fe Railroad, in a bid to get more people to come visit the West at that time, would feature a lot of these Indian artisans in their brochures and whatnot. And so she had a pretty good business. You know, she would make a lot of pots for the tourist trade and for a company called the Fred Harvey Company. They were a wholesaler, and they would buy these Indian wares and then sell them to the public at a profit. And my great-grandfather Winfred was actually an agent for the Fred Harvey Company. The railroads, of course, you know, it was to their benefit because they wanted a lot of tourism for the Southwest and particularly for the Four Corners region. But Nam Payoh was really a dwindling representative of the old way of doing things. And Eric recognized that, and he wanted to make sure that her designs were featured at the Denver Art Museum, along with some of the other people that still were using these older methods. But at the same time, you know, he didn't want designs to be limited to people of Nam Payoh's heritage and quality, because there were also contemporary artists at the time that were doing wonderful designs. And so rather than just limit it to traditional pieces, he also wanted to incorporate contemporary artists to prove to audiences that, you know, this is a living art. It's not something that's just trapped under glass. It's still happening. And it's art that mm-hmm. can still beautify your home. And not just pots, not just textiles, to sand paintings, just all manner of art that was being created during that time.
That felt like a very central theme throughout, is this, like, that these are living cultures, living art traditions, and you want to look at the stuff that's older to get the context, and also because they're great too, but this isn't just like an anthropological curiosity or something. This is like actually a thing that is worth paying attention to. Also, I want to make note, just because I can already hear the question, he did insist on the museum paying Nam Payoh for her work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, this was not a case of some guy coming in and sweeping in and, you know, taking advantage. He wanted to make sure that that these native creators actually had income from this. And so he mm-hmm. thought by putting them in the museum, that would generate more interest in going to these places where you could purchase the art and the creators would benefit. So absolutely.
As a public historian, I loved all this stuff about how the work he did at the Denver Art Museum. And then later on, one thing that really struck me is he didn't just buy these pots and stick them on a shelf. Like, he was out there doing the marketing and the work to get people interested. And you show him really like meeting people where they're at. So I loved this little scene where he just comes back from an interview and his assistant, Kate Peck Kent, is giving him a hard time because the interviewer used the pejorative term cigar store Indians.
Right.
And he kind of like launched off of that instead of being like, that is not an appropriate word. And I thought that was really clever. And also like, really smart of him. Like, he's meeting people where they're at. And he mm-hmm. did that in his museum designs too. Like, the stuff he did, I got really like big nerd over the museum design stuff. A lot of Good. Stuff we take for granted today was from him. And then also Renee, I don't know how to say this man's name, Harnoncourt, who I'd heard of.
Right.
Like, when I saw him show up, I was like, oh, he knew, like, they didn't just know each other. They were like buddies.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. They had sort of parallel paths a little bit. Renee was at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Eric was at the Denver Art Museum. And they both were experimenting with display techniques because they shared the same belief that if you do trap everything under glass, which at the time it was, these cramped cabinets full of things, you know, the only people that are going to be interested are what my grandfather would call eggheads that are really into it. They're going to hang around and look at it. And he said, I need to get this stuff out and I need to, you know, put it in places that display it in the way that it was meant to be displayed. Mm-hmm. And that meant putting pedestals up and walls and breaking up spaces, painting backgrounds so that the background of the piece reflected where it was made. In the case of Nam Payoh, in my book, I talk about a seed jar that she makes that's based on a vision that she has of Spider-Woman, who figures very prominently in Hopi culture. And so he wanted to paint the background like the sagebrush from the canyon, you know, mm-hmm. that Nam Payoh would draw her inspiration from. And he came across a lot of René de Harnoncourt's ideas at a time that was just the right time, because René was experimenting with how a visitor would really absorb what a museum had to offer. And he always put the museum visitor's perspective mm-hmm. down first. As I talk about in my book, he would have these sketch pads, and Eric adopted this technique of, you know, let's go through and just kind of lay it all out. And what am I looking at from left to right to center? How am I going to use lighting? How am I going to use color and height to try to differentiate things and really make it immersive, including leaving spaces dark so that if you had some beautiful gourd masks that were used in certain ritual dances, let's put them in the dark, but light them with a flickering light that simulates a campfire so you feel like you're there, you know, with these medicine men, and it would send a chill down your spine to see this on display that way. And René and Eric teamed up in 1939 at what a lot of people don't even realize ever happened. It was a World's Fair in San Francisco, and it was the Golden Gate Exposition of 1939. It was opened to celebrate the opening of the Golden Gate Bridge and the Oakland Bay Bridge. And part of it was designated as a tribute to Native American artists. René really pushed hard for this. He asked Eric to help him curate this show. And so they created what was called the Indian Hall. And it was this massive exhibition space where not only did they put in some of these innovative techniques that they developed, but they also brought in Native creators to demonstrate how they put together a pot, how they made a sand painting, how they wove a blanket, so that people visiting the exposition would be able to see in person that, yes, these are still, you know, artists that are doing their thing today, not just, you know, 50, 100 years ago. One of the things they brought to that exposition, which I was really fascinated by, was a mural of a war party on the plains. And to make it 3D, think about this, 1939, they had a beautiful painting of this war party, but then they kept the feathers on the war bonnets real. They, you know, were able to embed them into this painting. And then they ran a tube of compressed air up to the side out of view that was shooting a little stream of air so that the war bonnets were rippling as if they were in the wind riding on horseback. And that's pretty innovative even by today's yeah. standards.
Oh yeah, I was gonna say it seems like we're rediscovering a lot of this stuff that they already mm-hmm. did. Like when you're talking about keeping things out from under glass, there's a museum here in Philadelphia called Museum of the American Revolution. And one thing I really love about it is anything that is okay, that would be okay for people to touch, is available to touch. So like there's like a American Revolution era cannon, which you can touch because like it's a giant hunk of metal. It probably sat outside. Like it's fine. You can touch it. Like this isn't some delicate like piece of fabric or something. And they've got like things to smell. Like you can smell the tea like that they would have had at the Boston Tea Party and things like that. And all this stuff that I like will sing the praises of this museum. It's like he was doing this a while ago and we just sort of like forgot, I guess. We got.
And I'll tell you about this exposition. It also was a little bizarre because it was built up about 2 miles out into San Francisco Bay. They used the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to build an artificial island on which to put this thing.
Yeah,
and they had these multicolored searchlights that would shoot hundreds of feet up into the sky at night, like a Hollywood premiere, if you can imagine that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had to take a little water taxi to get out to this museum. And so it got the nickname of Magic City. Because if you can imagine looking out into the bay, it's no longer there. But seeing this little artificial island and all this activity and this light. And so it did have a serious element, but it also had some bizarre elements, which I reference in the book.
I mean, it's the 1930s. Like, they're going to do some weird stuff.
Very weird. They had a hokey miniature Western town, and I kid you not, they staffed it with little people dressed as cowboys school teachers and whatnot. They had a racetrack, and again, I wasn't there, so I can't vouch for this, but supposedly the racetrack had automobiles, little tiny automobiles driven by monkeys.
Oh my God.
And
they went all out, huh?
They really did. And they had Sally Rand's rope tricks. Sally Rand was sort of a burlesque queen. And so you could go pay your quarter and go into this area where you would look behind glass panels at these barely dressed cowgirls doing rope tricks. So, you know, and I can only imagine what my grandfather must have thought. What am I doing here? But
meet
you know,
people where they're at. You got to meet people where they're at.
There you go. That's a good point. But none of that bizarreness crept into the Indian court, I'm thankful to say.
Yeah, and actually quite the opposite in a lot of ways. So there were two artists that were brought up in this in the context of this. One was Red Robin, mm-hmm. who I just loved as a character. Red Robin is introduced. Was it Winfred, I think, introduced him to, yes. to Eric, and got him he was educated, and he was eventually hired, I think, or he worked with the Denver Art Museum.
Yeah, it's true. Winfred came across him on one of his many travels. I will say that Red Robin identified as a Zuni. He was mm-hmm. raised as a Zuni, mm-hmm. but we're pretty sure he was Hispanic. But
so that's where that was coming from. We were just talking to this. I was like, I saw something that was like, we're not sure, but the book, he says he's Zuni. Like,
right. Right. Yeah. Yeah, I must say that he has an interesting bit of mystery to his background, but he knew enough about the culture, and he was a very mm-hmm. talented sand painter that Winfred recognized that this guy is something special. So the family basically adopted him. They did give him his education. He came to Camp Neosho up in Evergreen quite frequently. In fact, my Aunt Eve, in her oral history for the museum up there in Evergreen, she treated him like an uncle or mm-hmm. almost like a father. And it was because Winfred and Eric were gone so much of the time. You know, Winfred, a lot for his work for Episcopalian music liturgy, mm-hmm. Eric for his work on behalf of the museum. And she revered Red Robin. She told a beautiful story about him that I incorporate in the book. There was a little creek that ran behind Camp Neosho. She called it a crick. He brought her down by the edge of the water. And he said, I want to teach you something, Eve. And he took a stick and he stirred up the bottom of this creek, stirred up the mud. And he asked her, she was a little girl. He said, what do you see? And she looked and she said, well, it's hard to see. It's all cloudy. He said, okay, well, let's just sit and wait for a little bit. So they sat and they waited. And then over time, it started to clear. The water started to clear. And that was his way of telling Eve that you have to be patient with life. And that when you get these troubles, when things happen, just be patient. It'll clear up eventually. But Red Robin was this expert sand painter. My novel places him at the San Francisco event in 1939. He never was there. I'm afraid that okay. was one thing that I did okay. invent a little bit. But his relationship to the Douglas family and his work as a sand painter is very true. He, on purpose, left out certain details because he knew that if you made a sacred sand painting, that was an offense to the gods. And so he always purposely made mistakes so it would be non-sacred. Eric did the same thing. He would sometimes paint figures on the walls of the home at Camp Neosho, and he left out certain details so that it wouldn't be considered sacred and offensive.
Yeah, that really struck us because, like,
we were talking about this last night, actually.
Yeah, because since we're Jewish and, like, we have some friends who have converted, and one of the parts of the conversion, like, process is you're supposed to, like, follow the law, but only just so much. And so people who are, like, super Orthodox, like, follow the law, like, super precisely, will, like, at the end of the Sabbath, like, flick the lights once just so that they don't technically do it. Like, it reminded me of that. But then also what I thought was really great about this is you had this extended scene where a different artist has a child with them who has their legs have been, or something's wrong with their legs from polio.
Yeah, that I appreciate you bringing that up. Her name was Mary Little Bear Inkinish, And she was a Southern Cheyenne craftswoman. And just like Nanpeo, she was doing things in the old traditional way of making sure that deer skin was used when she would make these beautiful, you know, buckskin dresses. And the beadwork was so intricate. She would make moccasins that were for weddings and for funerals. And she would put beads on the top and the bottom, because whether it was a funeral or a wedding, you never were to touch the ground. And that's why she put the beads underneath, so that you would have to be carried if you were the bride, or obviously if you were the deceased, you would be carried to the ceremony. But anyway, Mary Little Bear, she was invited to be a demonstrator at the Golden Gate Exposition in 1939 to show some of the beautiful textiles and the beadwork that she was known for. And she did know of a little girl named Dolly Lee. Dolly Lee was the daughter of another Navajo craftsman. She had polio. And when some of the white people connected with the show realized that she had this bad leg, they wanted to take her to a hospital in San Francisco. Well, her father wanted to try the old way of healing first, and wanted to do a sand painting to heal her. So this was something that both the Navajo and the Zuni would do with these sand paintings. And in the ceremony, the person who has an affliction is sat down in the sand painting that is created. And at the end of the ceremony, the sand is then brought up and daubed on the body of the person that you want to heal. And this actually did happen. Mary Little Bear came to Eric and Renee and said, Dolly Lee's dad and family wants to try this, and they need to do it in the Indian court. So will you shut this place down so that they can do this? It will take all night. We have to be done by sunrise because we don't want to risk a curse. That was the thought. Mm-hmm. And so they agreed. And it was at great expense. It was at a time when they were just starting to finally get crowds to come into the Indian court to see all of this. And there was a lot of back and forth to get the approvals. But they did shut it down, and they did allow Eric and Renee and just a few select others to come into this rarely seen ceremony in which they did tear up a sand painting to try to help Dolly Lee. So I think between a combination of that healing ceremony, and she did end up going to the hospital, mm-hmm. it did help her leg.
Yeah, and I loved that part of the book too, of this sort of like matter of fact, like that these are both valid traditions, both valid ways to go about things. But that's an incredible thing to shut, especially there was WPA money involved. So like
exactly.
So that was not a small thing to shut it down. And mm-hmm. the fact that they did that speaks volumes.
And Eric maintained his friendship with Mary Little Bear for the rest of his life. And she was so saddened by his death. She said quite famously, "We will never see his like again." That's how I end the book. But they had this beautiful friendship, and he encouraged her to try to pass on her way of doing this dressmaking and this beadwork to other people within her culture. And sometimes, you know, she was successful, but other times she was not. It was very hard work. It was hard on the hands, you know. Mm-hmm. Imagine trying to punch through deer skin with an awl. She just was this lively, beautiful sprite of a woman who came alive to me through my research.
There's tanning involved too, which is just not
exactly
the most pleasant process to be involved with. Ms. Ollie, you had a hard time finding stuff.
Yeah, I tried to do some research, and there was one website that had one sentence, and then there was another website that had another sentence, and both of those sentences said she did beadwork, and that was basically it. And then I saw there was a book about her. Let me pull the title.
I believe it's called Dance Around the Sun.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Dance Around the Sun, The Life of Mary Little Bear Inkanish, Cheyenne, by Alice Marriott and Carol K. Ratchlin. I couldn't see without sourcing the book. I couldn't see any information in it, but we are planning to source the book and read it.
Yeah.
Well, again, she's a perfect D-lister of history as
that
well.
That was our thought. Especially because one place we have been a little negligent on is like Indigenous people of North mm-hmm. America. In part just because that's not where my expertise lies.
Gap important. We would like to fill.
Yeah, it's an important gap to fill. Oh, and then there was this other piece. There was about Mary Little Bear, as in the book, has this conversation with Eric about trying to get other younger people involved in the type of art she was doing, and how in that way that I think is typical of the first generation after people are usually unimpressed with the generation in front of them.
Yes.
And it's not until you go one or two generations down that people are like, wait, what is this? And I just loved that idea of like, we're preserving this stuff so that when those kids are like, I want to reconnect with this aspect of my culture, they can. Like, here it is.
Well, I appreciate that. And yes, it's true. She did struggle because it's very hard work, you know, making dresses in that traditional way. It would take weeks, sometimes months, to make these pieces. And that, again, gives you this appreciation for all that went into them. But yeah, for her, her frustration was a lot of the younger women were just wanting to go get their things out of a store and not necessarily spend the time to make them.
Which, I mean, that was that era, I think that's a common refrain throughout.
And I've seen a lot of people reconnecting with traditional ways of creating fiber arts. I mean, I'm a fiber artist myself, so I just travel in those circles. And I have seen a lot of people reconnecting and wanting to reconnect with their own culture's traditions in that sense. And I think that's wonderful.
And it's such a gift, too, because, like, as an Ashkenazi Jewish person, we lost so much, and there's no getting it back. And through the attempted cultural genocide of the indigenous people in North America, a lot, I'm sure, was lost, but a lot was kept. And this felt like a part of that story, like an aspect of that story, and really showed, like, I mean, this was sort of something I wanted to bring up at the end, but you talked about Anne sort of being potentially motivated by being descended from someone who is, you know, part of the Sand Creek Massacre. I think this book gives a lot of sort of a roadmap for people who want to uplift marginalized communities, but aren't entirely sure how to do that without being obnoxious.
Or disrespectful. Do you mind if I tell you a little bit more about Renee and Eric?
Please do.
So a couple of years after the San Francisco exhibition, which was very successful, they teamed up again for a big exhibit at MoMA in New York, Museum of Modern Art. They took a lot of the lessons from the San Francisco experience and applied it in New York. They, again, invited Native American artists to come and be demonstrators. At the entrance to MoMA, Renee had a big totem pole from Alaska installed for the duration of the show. Again, think about the innovation at that time. And here's, you know, big New York City, and all of a sudden there's a totem pole put down in Manhattan. You know, it was a real conversation stopper. And then the exhibit itself, they employed these techniques of immersion again, whether it was the color, whether it was the lighting. They actually brought in some Hopi creators from Arizona to do facsimiles of kivas, again, non-sacred, but these subterranean chambers in which visitors could descend on ladders as if they were in Arizona and to see the artwork on walls, pictographs. And one of the visitors to this particular show in 1941 was Eleanor Roosevelt.
Yes.
And she was extremely impressed by the care with which they put into this show and the fact that they were really involving a lot of the Native creators and helping design and develop it. The Roosevelts had a very interesting connection to the Douglas family. Way back in the day, Teddy Roosevelt, after he had lost his re-election bid to Woodrow Wilson, he was politically injured, and he thought the best way to try to fix his feeling of, oh, woe is me, let me go out into the Southwest, let me ride horseback, let me get out there and, you know, be my robust Teddy again. And so Winfred Douglas served as a cultural guide for Teddy Roosevelt. A lot of the areas that he was very familiar with, you know, he brought Roosevelt and Natalie Curtis, who I mentioned, introduced them to the Hopi people and some of the other Native Americans. But there was one member of the Roosevelt family that was not a fan of Winfred Douglass. And I make reference to this in the book. And his name was Nick Roosevelt. He was a cousin. And he called my great-grandfather an insufferable idiot. And you know, he did seem to have this sort of Boy Scout approach to life. He was very enthusiastic, over-enthusiastic, some people would say. And it got to the point where, you know, some people were really turned off by that and his enthusiasm for the subject, whether it was Episcopal music or Native American art. And so Nick was never a big fan of Winfred, but I think Teddy Roosevelt tolerated him. And in my book, Eleanor Roosevelt, she remembers this connection with Teddy. She actually wrote the foreword to a book that Eric and Renee wrote for this 1941 exhibit, Indian Art of the United States, in which she did talk about the importance of preserving this legacy of Native American art and sharing it with the American people. He took it one step further because the success of both San Francisco and New York led him to create the Indian Style Show. I don't know that this would fly today.
Yeah, it was really interesting. I had some questions
but
about
if you look at it, if you look at it through the lens of the 1940s and the 1950s, I think I can understand why Eric Douglass did this. We've been talking a lot about Native American textiles, and in particular dresses and dressmaking and buckskin and all that. Well, the Denver Art Museum had this beautiful collection, and he thought, just like not wanting to trap things under glass, he also didn't want to just keep these beautiful dresses on mannequins. And so it was Eric's idea, and I think Frida may have planted the seed a little bit, to do fashion shows. Let's get models to wear these beautiful pieces of art so you can see how they actually look. And so, like a Vogue magazine show, he would narrate taking fashion terms that he learned by picking up Vogue magazine. And as these models would parade before white audiences, and they were white models, he would describe these different beautiful dresses and the eras in which they came. And he would mix some from the mid-1800s with, again, contemporary designs to show that, you know, this is a living piece of art that you're watching. They were a smash hit. He would, by design, go to, you know, some of the ladies' clubs in Denver and some of the other places that he would present. And he did this all over the United States. But he would have sort of the same modus operandi. He would be the narrator. He would have these women bring out these dresses, some of which were real showstoppers. But at the same time, he was teaching them a bit of history and, again, trying to subtly send the message that fashion is fashion. Doesn't matter if it's Native American, doesn't matter, you know, who made it, it's still beautiful and you should appreciate it. And there was a lot of racist stereotypes going on. Hollywood was in overdrive with a lot of the Westerns that were depicting Native American women in very derogatory ways and in very one-dimensional ways. But it was another successful way of sort of immersing white audiences in this culture and helping them to understand its beauty.
And I think I do want to point out, so today, if this was done today, which is kind of a false comparison because I don't think something like that, it's just, this is so of its time. But it's easy, I guess, would be the way to say it now. It's easy for us to kind of look at the use of white models and be like, what? Like, yeah. No, like today that today we'd say like you need to use all Native models, but I thought it was interesting the reasoning. And I thought this was, given that there's so much of this conversation happening around cultural appropriation, things like that, I thought this was really interesting because his goal, it seemed to me, was to get these women to like purchase fashion from these Native makers. Mm-hmm. And the reason he used white models was a specific choice he made so that the audience would see themselves in these works.
That is a wonderful point. And by extension, some of the people that were in the audience were fashion designers of the day. And it's interesting if you look, I'm no fashion expert of this era, but if you look back on the 40s and 50s, you would start to see from these designers in New York and some of the other fashion centers would start incorporating Native American designs into their modern work. Now, was that appropriation? Yes, I suppose you could say, but I would rather think that, as Eric thought, look, fashion is fashion, women are women, and you know, just appreciate it for the beauty that it is. He also did experiment briefly with doing it with male models. Mm-hmm. As you know from having read the book, he was also in the military. He was stationed in New Hebrides during World War II, commanded a hospital, was in charge of 130 nurses. He was in contact with the Denver Art Museum through correspondence, kind of rankled the administrators of the Denver Art Museum that here was this guy who was off to war, and he was still having this outsized influence on the way the Denver Art Museum was being
run. I kind of understand that frustration.
but they did want to experiment with convalescing soldiers at Buckley Base in Denver wearing male fashions. And I think they tried it perhaps once, but the reception wasn't nearly as enthusiastic as it was with women. And so, but these fashion shows, these Indian style shows, continued into the 50s and for a period of time after his death, but then they died out.
And I guess the ideal would have been if somehow, like, I just thinking about the, you know, fashion designers then being inspired by that. I mean, I guess the question is then, like, it would have been nice if there was some monetary, like,
right
thing to the original artists. But just for the sake of time, I'm going to kind of like zip over the World War II Pacific Theater, but I did want to highlight a couple of things. One was, and this actually we saw before this, but I forgot to mention it, was it seemed like the Douglas family had just a lot of strong women hanging around and had a lot of admiration, I guess. So like he picked the person he picked to be his, I don't think assistant's the right word, aide-de-camp? I don't know.
Yeah, aide-de-camp. Mm-hmm.
Real tough lady, as my my relatives would call some of my family members, and I loved that. And also then that he was a big supporter of this newfangled idea of neuropsychiatric care for what we now call PTSD.
It was brand new back then, and you know, I think what I found really interesting about that period of his life was the way that he, you know, remember, he grew up in a household full of art and music, especially from his father, who would compose, you know, at his pump organ in his study at Camp Neosho. And they would have these classical records that they would play, Rachmaninoff, for example. Mm-hmm. And Eric recognized the therapy that this kind of music could bring to patients coming back from the front lines of the Pacific War that were shell-shocked, was the term back then. Mm-hmm. And not only in listening to classical music by phonograph, but he was also put together choirs of patients and would have them sing some of these classical pieces. And he was constantly asking his family back in Colorado, please send more scores, because they love this. And it's clearly having an impact on their health and bringing them back some semblance of normalcy. They love that music that they played in the South, in the New Hebrides area.
Yeah, and I mean, now music therapy is a accepted...
art therapy, yeah. They're just taken for granted.
Right? Yeah, this is a thing that happens. And I hadn't thought about it from the music therapy perspective when I read it, but like, yeah, he was like so ahead of his time in so many ways, but that was one of them. Unfortunately, he didn't live very long after the war.
No, he didn't. It's something that I always look at, that brief life. Born in 1897, died in 1956, and so much that he packed into those years. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I just, there was something about people of that era, because I've come across it, Winfrey, same thing. It's almost like they just had this inner fire. And I don't know too many people contemporaneously that have it. I'm sure that we have them. But I look back at their lives and I just marvel at what they were able to accomplish. Eric had a special relationship with these nurses, and we won't go into too much detail, but he was known as Pappy by his nurses, and he called them his chicks. Again, sorry, think of the time. So it was Pappy and his chicks, and he would write these wonderful little leaflets about the nurses, and he had little descriptions for each one that they could keep, you know, and sort of look back on years later. And when he had cancer, this terrible bone cancer, he really did not want to tell them the truth about how severe it was. And so he carried on this cheerful correspondence. They would have these reunions and, you know, yeah, I'm going to be fine. I'm going to beat this. And it got to the point where they had to amputate one of his arms. And even with the cancer, with the arm off, with the exhaustion, with the fatigue, he kept up this vigorous external appearance. He was still in demand because museums all over the country and overseas wanted Eric Douglas to come and authenticate a lot of the items that they had in their collection. Is this something we should keep? Is this something we should purchase? And because he had this vast reservoir of knowledge, he was called upon to do that. And so he traveled even while sick, including, as I mentioned in the book, to the Logan Museum of Anthropology in Beloit, Wisconsin. And he's in a wheelchair and he's evaluating this collection that the museum had gotten to determine how much of it should go on display. And this was one of the most emotional things for me in researching this book, because I was 2 years old when Eric died. And I only had this vague image of this tall, scary one-armed giant, because he was a tall man. He was a tall man, and I don't remember much more than that. And so when I learned about this visit that he had really in the year before he died to the Logan Museum, I ran across a reference to the fact that a tape recording was made of that visit as he went through this collection, just so that it would make it easier on the secretary later to transcribe, you know, what was what. So I spent most of those 2 years tracking down this recording, you know, and I found it. And it was wonderful. In the Logan Museum archives, but it was from 1955. It was in really bad shape.
I bet.
And so I had it sent to a audio lab in Salt Lake City, and they were able to restore it. And if you guys can imagine, when I finally got the digital file, my heart was beating through my chest. I'd never heard the voice of my grandfather consciously. And then to hit that play button and to hear his voice, it was very emotional.
I bet.
It was very emotional. And it was so vigorous. And it was so deep. And it was so full of life. And it brought him to life for me. And there's a sequence where he is picking up, I believe it's a dress that has some tin jigglers on the fringe. And he's, you know, playing with that to show, you know, the people at the museum, this is how they use this in their ceremonial dance. Or he would pick up a whistle and that was also used in another dance. And then he would beat his good hand on the desk in time with the whistle to give them a sense of what it must have been like. And it was about a half hour's worth of material. It was just, that was worth it to me in writing this book, to get access to that tape and to hear my grandfather for the first time.
Yeah, well, I really think you brought him alive in this book. I really felt like I knew him by the end of it. It was
for sure
really part dynamic. Of why we do this podcast is one of those people that like do something interesting and are changing the world in some way and they haven't necessarily heard about them. So how I want to sort of pull this together is how would you suggest that anybody who's listening who might want to be a part of like that continuation of that mission of his of like encouraging this equalization of Indigenous art alongside European and American European art?
I would say for sure, patronize your museum because of Eric Douglas and René de Haraucourt and people like them. Fortunately, I'd see in most major American cities, you will find a section of Native American art, Indigenous art. The Denver Art Museum, of course, for me, there's no place finer to come. So if you're ever in Denver, please come to look at a lot of the art, which not only was collected by the Douglas family, but many others. And there is a current exhibit, I'm very proud to say, called Weaving a Foundation. And this actually pays tribute to Eric Douglas. And I was really concerned for quite a while that his legacy was starting to fade at the Denver Art Museum. And this new curator of textile art, Jill DeSandro, came in from San Francisco, learned a little bit about the whole Douglas legacy by going into the archives. Who is this guy? My gosh, look at all that he did. And so she decided on her own to bring out a lot of the textile material that has never been on view. There are 60 objects, two-thirds of which first time are being seen. And she called it Weaving a Foundation. It highlights many of these pieces that Eric and his dad collected and donated to the museum. And it will tell his story through the art that is on display. So that's one way. If you are lucky enough to visit the Four Corners region, places like Mesa Verde National Park, the Heard Museum in Phoenix, some of these other wonderful cultural centers, not only appreciate the art that is made, but buy it. You know, yes. support these artists, these current contemporary artists that are still making these beautiful things. And that is how I think you can continue that legacy. Yeah.
And as I think Eric would say, not just making it, but continue like improving upon it and building that legacy in a way that anybody does in their own culture.
It's a living,
living, breathing thing.
That's right.
I'm just scrolling through this exhibit, and there's a coat from Romania. This is so cool. Thank you so much for sharing this story with us.
Yes, thank you.
This was such a delightful person to sort of meet through history.
And I love learning, meeting all these other people around him as well.
Yeah, like it was just, there were a lot of incredible people around him that also are D-listers, so to speak. And we might visit a few of them in the future. But
I would love for you to, if you're ever in my neck of the woods, I'd love to take you guys out for coffee and talk a little bit more about Eric. If I could just do a shameless plug, which
absolutely, sure, oh please, I'm sorry. I should please.
No,
please,
you're
I'm
fine.
Sorry.
so my book is called Poppy, a novel about a colorful Colorado life. You can find it on Amazon, or I do have a website that's a bit of a mouthful, sandgoatmanorpublishing.com. Again, sandgoatmanor, all one, publishing.com. And you can find not only a lot about Eric there, but I've got a little bit of multimedia, some pictures of the people that are featured in my book. Mm-hmm. And from my TV life, my multimedia life, I did a piece about Camp Neosho, now the Hiawan mm-hmm. Homestead Museum, and how school children that visit learn about, you know, the Douglas family in the early days by visiting. So I hope you check it out.
Thank you so much for listening to D-Listers of History. If you enjoyed yourself, please drop us a review on whatever platform you listen on. Also, tell your friends who might enjoy our show.
We are a weekly podcast. Our next episode will be out Monday, March 25th, and we'll cover the historical context around some current event that's hitting the news cycle around that time. On Monday, April 1st, we will drop our next biography episode, where Mazal and I will chat about the novelist Baroness Orsi and what her hero, the Scarlet Pimpernel, has to do with Batman.
Check out the show notes for all of our social media pages. You can also find them on our website, www.dlistersofhistory.com. There's no dash in there, all one word. Also be sure to check out our new Substack for a selection of primary source documents relevant to each episode.
A big thank you to all of our patrons. We couldn't do this without you. And now, an episode-relevant audio drop.
Grandpa's do that one. They're showing. Scrying around. Grandpa's just standing still, bobbing down.
This has this piece of other stuff at the end.
It sounds like a watercolor. Yeah, they're all, used to have a feather. They're perfectly good whistles, but the discs are pretty sad. I think they were.
Well, I don't know if we keep
that. Well, that one's a handsome swimming rock, which isn't saying you get too much.
No.
I want to look at this picture.
Yeah.